Ever have that feeling you don't belong? That you're not good enough or not qualified for something? It's called imposter syndrome, and when it comes to women in mathematics, it's one of the issues that women face when it comes to applying for promotions, awards, and even funding.
Oh, I've sort of done this stuff, you know, blah, 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 and then you get them in to interview them and you talk to them and realise that they are absolutely sensational and they've been underselling themselves because they don't think they have these certain abilities.
That's Dr. Sophie Calabretto, a senior lecturer in the Department of Mathematics at Macquarie University. Sophie is a two-time finalist for the Eureka Prize for promoting the understanding of science. The Eurekas are considered the Oscars of science here in Australia. ABC Radio National selected her in 2017 as one of its top five under 40 scientists, and she's even appeared on the ABC's Catalyst program. Sophie spends a great deal of time and energy promoting mathematics and women in STEM.
The more that you do stuff, the more you get asked to do stuff, and I think it's that same thing. You're like, well, I could say no, and if I don't do it, who's going to do it?
I spend so much time telling all the women that I know, you know, to say that no, you can do this, you have the ability, you have the skills, get the confidence.
That's Professor Asha Rao, the Associate Dean for Mathematical Sciences at RMIT and a 2019 Science and Technology Australia Superstar of STEM. As Interim Director of the Australian Mathematical Sciences Institute, or AMSI, Asha is acutely aware of the low numbers of females in maths at the university level. According to AMSI, here is the percentage of women in the mathematical sciences in Australia. 38% at the undergraduate level, the number drops to 33% for PhDs, to 20% for academic staff, levels A to E, and just 10% at level E for professors and above. Asha is also doing all she can to affect change.
I remember somebody saying, but then society has to change before we change. And I said, what happened with the idea that universities are the hotbed of democracy, of change? So what happened to that idea? So yes, there was a lot of pushback.
In this episode, we explore why the numbers are so low for women in maths, the role women are being asked to play in making that change, and the messages both Asha and Sophie have for women and men when it comes to this issue. Professor Asha Rao and Dr. Sophie Calabretto, our guests for this episode of The Random Sample. Welcome to The Random Sample, a podcast by the Australian Research Council Centre of Excellence for Mathematical and Statistical Frontiers. I'm Emily Duane. In this show, we share stories about mathematics, statistics, and the people involved. You can learn more about what the centre does by visiting our website, asems.org.au. That's acems.org.au. Our host for this episode is Dr. Savandi Kandanarachi, a lecturer at RMIT University in Melbourne and an ASIMS Associate Investigator.
Welcome to The Random Sample, and I'd like to welcome back Professor Asha Rao and Dr. Sophie Calabretto. In our last episode, we chatted about the importance of mathematics education. Today, we are talking women in mathematics.
And often the question about women in mathematics is also this lack of confidence, more than a lack of ability between men and women in mathematics. Even from school days, there might be a lack of confidence. And I've got to say, when I teach classes, I've often noticed female students who are at the top of the class sometimes, but their confidence levels are much, much lower. So how do we boost the confidence in females in mathematics?
I think you just keep telling them, this is what I do. I tell my PhD students, especially my female PhD students, that you get me for life. You become my student, I'm there. And they always come back. And most of the message I'm giving to people is, yes, you can do it. Yes, you know it. You know, don't let the imposter syndrome get in the way. And you know what? I have had my own mentor say exactly the same thing to me.
So it's worked.
It has worked for me as well. So every time I want to do something, and you know, the imposter syndrome, when I was asked to put my hand up for the interim director's position, which I knew was going to be hard, I had one of the other heads ring me up, and he says, now don't you say I can't do this little one thing. I had such a laugh about it because that was what it was. It was imposter syndrome. And I spent so much time telling all the women that I know, you know, the younger women and even the older women that I know, to say that, no, you can do this. You have the ability, you have the skills, get the confidence. And I was doing exactly the same thing, wasn't I?
Sophie, what do you think? How can we, thanks, Asha. Yeah, how can we improve the confidence?
Well, I was going to say, I think you might be talking to the wrong person because I constantly feel like I have no idea what I'm doing all the time. So I'm the worst person to ask but I think that positive reinforcement is really helpful because I think I often second guess myself in almost everything I do. And it's not that I need constant reassurance, but it is nice to have someone go, look, just take a breath. You're doing a great job. Or like you're doing I think that has always been really helpful where I've gone. You know, I even remember, my final honors presentation, and I was practicing the weekend before, and I think this thing was on a Monday or a Tuesday. It must have been on the Tuesday because I remember emailing my supervisor on the Monday being like, I've got no idea what I'm doing. I was trying to run through this thing. I hit these few slides and like, I'm really confused about this computational process. Like, blah, blah. And he went, come see me in my office. And I went, and he went, you know what you're talking about. Calm down. Like if when you try to present this bit, you're getting caught up in the details, then omit some of those details. No one will realize. And the people who will ask you a question at the end of it. And you can explain it when you're a little bit calmer and you've done your presentation. And it was just, so yeah, I'm terrible with imposter syndrome, but I'm just going to say, I think the things that make me feel a bit better is just every so often getting that little bit of reassurance from someone. So it might be a mentor, it might be a colleague being like, you're doing a good job. You deserve to be here. Everything that you've achieved, you've worked hard for. People haven't been giving you handouts to get here. Like, you've earned your spot. Just believe in yourself sometimes. So yeah, and I think, and I, it's interesting because I was, we were talking about the AustMS diversity panel just before we started recording. And, one of the things that I mentioned, which is interesting, is that at Macquarie University, in terms of promotion, now they require everyone to have an interview stage. So it doesn't matter if you're going from A to B or B to C, you do your written application and then everyone does an interview. And it's just, you know, with the panel in the faculty and an external person, and, you know, so it's pretty standard. And what they found is that in all of the very impressive applications from men, when you come in to interview them, it turns out they're actually far less impressive than they are on paper when you start talking to them about what they've done. And it was the opposite with the women. So you'd get these very, oh, I've sort of done this stuff, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then you get them in to interview them and you talk to them and realize that they're absolutely sensational and they've been underselling themselves because they don't think they have these certain abilities. And for some reason, you know, men seem far more confident. And, you know, I think back to, you know, is this a learned trait that we pick up subconsciously once we start going to school? Like, is this a societal problem? And it perpetuates everything, I think, in a way that we do understand, but maybe not sort of the gravity of how damaging these kinds of stereotypes are that we're, we end up digesting at a young age.
I think so, Sophie. I think there is this constant message put out to females, you know, even before, because I've been reading quite a bit about these things, is that even before you go to school, the stereotype is that you don't speak until you're spoken to.
Or you're the nice one.
That's right.
Right? Like, yeah.
You have to be friendly and caring and you look out for other people. And, you know, I feel like even from primary school, some of the guys were just a bit more ruthless. Like, they were there for themselves and they were like, it's about me now. Yes. And, I think, you know, and obviously that's a gross generalization, but I think, you know, that part of it is this sort of learnt, and I even saw it in my niece and nephew a little bit. So we do not believe in binary gender norms in our family, and all of, you know, so my niece and nephew were both raised in sort of very gender neutral ways, and yet the second they went to kindy or school and they start hanging around with their peers who maybe weren't raised in the same way, and all of a sudden it's like, it's about dinosaurs and throwing things and being violent, or it's about princesses and pink and all this, you know, and that didn't exist before. Yeah. And then, you know, but then at the same time, you know, and then they've, you know, evolved and, you know, they're now into lots of different kinds of things. But it's just interesting how the second that it becomes a topic of conversation, it becomes really important. So having my niece say, Sophie, I'm a girl and you're a woman, and that means you're an adult girl. Like, you know, it's this very important thing that they've learned, that there are girls and there are boys and they're different.
With the confidence, I often wonder, like, you know, you submit grant applications in academia, does the confidence seep in when they read the grant application and see, oh, they're going to do wonderfully well? And, you know,
I know what you mean. It's an interesting question, and I know that, you know, so I have a bit to do with the high performance computing community in Australia, and so the NCI, which is the National Computational Infrastructure, so, you know, the big supercomputer in Australia and Canberra, and they do their merit allocation scheme. So a lot of people can get time on the supercomputer through their universities, but then they have this national merit allocation scheme where you apply straight to them for time on the supercomputer. And what they did in the most recent round is that they went to basically faceless applications. So they used, it was a thing that they'd done a while ago in the US to get time on, like, the Hubble Space Telescope, and everything became anonymous. And that included anonymizing, you know, and it was quite difficult because, you know, what they want to know about is your track record and all this other kind of stuff. And it's quite hard to anonymize that. But, you know, they've got some kind of system, because what they found is, and so it's the first time they've done it at the NCI, so that they won't have data for like a few years. But when they did it for Hubble, it meant that there were so many more women being allocated time. And I think, you know, it could possibly be due to that. So one, unconscious bias of the people reading the applications, but two, potentially, you know, if people are underselling themselves in an application for promotion, they're probably underselling themselves in an application for a research grant or for something else. Yeah. So I think, yeah, the point you make is really interesting, Savandi.
And I don't even know if they're underselling themselves, because Harvard did studies on that. They did studies on the fact that the people in, say, for example, a philharmonic, an orchestra, were predominantly male, and then they did these they did auditioning behind a screen and said that everybody should wear just runners, because the women were being identified by their high heels. So once they did all of that, there were more women.
Yeah, so I mean, that really is then just, yeah, the natural bias of the people selected.
The bias comes in.
Yeah.
The bias is there, and that's a systemic bias. Yeah. It's not that the women are underselling. It is when you take an application, and Harvard showed that whether it was men or women who were judging the application, both with, you know, identical CVs, identical applications with different names, you know, one female, one male, both men and women thought that the men would be better, even though the CV was identical.
Yeah, and we get, and I was going to say, that's not just a woman-man problem. Then you've also got cultural biases and all these other things as well.
It is cultural bias.
Yeah.
This was later, like, you know, so I think this year or last year, they showed that this went on to the next level, where they trained the AI to recruit from the CVs, and the AI was recruiting more males because that's what it had seen.
That is what it had been trained. So, you know, one of the other superstars of STEM, Munira Banu, is currently working with Deakin. She's an AI. She looks at software, and she said, well, what happened was they took pieces of text in English. So it said things like, she is a doctor, he is a nurse. So then they translated it using something like Google Translate, for example, into Farsi. So Farsi, which is a language from Iran, doesn't have gender. And I know that if you meet Iranians, they find it really, really hard to say he and she if they were educated in Iran. They will say he when it's a girl, and they will say she when it's a man. It's a total con, this thing. And then, you know what they did then? They retranslated back into English. And the AI then converted every she is a doctor into he is a doctor, and she is a nurse into he is a nurse. Because it's the people, the bias of the people who are writing the algorithms. And the first computers were female, but computer science at this point is the one profession which really, really suffers with the gender imbalance. It's the people who are writing it. So AI is a reflection of society, not something, you know, out of this, I don't know, created by God, if there was a God.
Asha, I wanted to ask you at this point, so the Women in Mathematics Special Interest Group, which is a special interest group in the Australian Mathematics Society, OSTMS. So you were the inaugural director of WIMSIC.
The
inaugural chair of WIMSIC. So now I would like to think like more people know about WIMSIC, and you know, it has it's well known within the community, right? It's not like well known outside, but still well known within the community. So great work, well done. But what I wanted to ask you was, when you started this initiative, which is like a really big leadership initiative to start, what's the story in starting, and how did you, you know, was there pushback from, you know, from everywhere? How was that?
It was. So, you know, I didn't actually start the organization. So the way it started was the OSTMS had been thinking about it for a few years. I have written an article 2 years on which tracks the history. So then they decided, end of 2012, they decided finally that we would have a WIMSIC. And so women, you know, there was a call out to, do you want to be a member of this, of the special interest group? And do you want to nominate for one of the committee positions, you know, so one of my colleagues said to me, I want to nominate you. And I said, yeah, that's fine. You can nominate me as an ordinary member. So it turned out, you know, there was a secretary and somebody who had nominated for treasurer, but then there were five people who had nominated for ordinary member, and nobody had nominated for chair. Or I think, for chair, I don't know if there was a deputy, I don't think there was a deputy chair. So nobody had nominated for chair. So then we got an email, so those of us who had nominated, to say that, okay, so is one of you ready to step up and be the chair? Because if you are not going to do that, then we may have a man come in and be the chair, because some person has put their hand up. And I looked at that and I thought, we cannot have that. So I said, okay, I will be the chair. So I had this fantastic committee. We met every month for the 2-3 years. So 2 years I was the chair. And then the next year, I think I was the immediate past chair when Leslie Ward became the chair. And we put in a huge number of things. We put in, a submission to the decadal plan for the mathematical sciences. We instituted awards. We did a huge amount of work. But boy, was there pushback. So the first time it was, I think, 2014, February, the Australian Council of the Heads of Mathematical Sciences meet at AMSI. And I was invited as the chair to present. And the things that were thrown at me were things like, oh, but there are no qualified females in this area. Because we said, okay, so if you have a conference, you need to try and get an equal number of females. So AMSI put that into its conditions in the plenary speakers. Oh, we don't have. When there is a job advertised, you need to have an equal number of women. Oh, but there aren't any. So at that point, Nalini Joshi was there at that meeting and she really supported me, and that was really good. I remember somebody saying, but then society has to change before we change. And I said, what happened with the idea that universities are the hotbed of democracy, of change? So what happened to that idea? So yes, there was a lot of pushback. There was a lot of pushback, but I've never been the sort of person to shy away. So some of the things we put in, for example, we asked AMSI to ensure that people had, as you know, tried, even if they didn't get it, they tried to get balance, gender balance, whether it was in plenary speakers. And so they had to do things like, if AMSI was going to sponsor a workshop, they had to try and get childcare. So I still remember, it was very funny, I would have people write to me and saying, I don't know how to do this, but I'm prepared to sit and mind the children. I was like, no, we're not asking you to mind children. You can at your local university get some places, you know. There were people who wrote to me and said, that was the other side of this. So when this happened, people then assume that we would do this for them. So they would write to us, to the committee, and say, can you find us speakers? I was like, no, that is not my job. It's your job. And then, you know, people, there aren't anybody. It was like, okay, can you tell me how many people you have tapped on the shoulder? How many people have you reached out to? You know, we put this advertisement and only two people applied and there were 60 men. How many women did you encourage to apply? So those things have changed. People are more naturally doing that now.
Yes, I do think WIMSI has had like a really positive impact. Mm-hmm. It can have more, and I hope it continues to have more. It's definitely not the end or anything like that. But now people know more about it. And as you said, there's more tapping on the shoulders and encouragement, which is so important in many, many things. Yes. And another thing that I wanted to ask both of you is like, you know, the so sometimes with awards, because both of you have won lots of awards and like, you know, sort of with awards, like say, for example, you know, the Ostermes medal, it's for the prerequisite is you have to be under 40. And that's the same for the Fields medal. You have to be under 40. So and so many people have said, and then that this creates like a disadvantage for women because during like 30 to 40, you have children and you take breaks and you're juggling a lot and all that, whereas it's not the same for men. So so because of that, there's this unfair, it's a disadvantage to women. So what are your thoughts about this, and, you know, how can you go about to make it a bit better?
So with the, and it was the same thing with the Fields Medal, that it was for early career, you know, that you did your major work before you turned 40, which does definitely, and that basically you can see it's reflected in the fact that there's only one woman so far who has won the Fields Medal. And she won it barely before she turned 40. So, and that is a problem. We need to look at those things. The other thing with all the awards, one of the things that has happened is, being one of the superstars of STEM, I've had my sister superstars tap me on the shoulder. You have a couple of people who will constantly message me and say, there is this award happening, shall I nominate you? It does, remember, nominating is not easy. It does take a huge amount of effort from the person who's being nominated. Because the person who's nominating you doesn't know you really. So you have to write this application. So that, and I applied for the Superstar of STEM basically at the very last moment because I had gone around the discipline and tapped on every office door of every female and said, can you apply for this? And nobody wanted to. They said, oh, maybe next time. I'm too busy. Then I thought about it and I thought, I need to walk the walk. So I decided, so it was due on the Monday. So on the Sunday afternoon, I put in an application. But I must say, the more I wrote it, the more I crafted it, the more I realized, yes, I am the right person for this.
Yes, oh, I think you are, yeah.
But you know what, Sivandi, when I did get it, quite a few people in mathematics turned around, not quite a few people, I should say, not quite a few, a minor, you know, minimum, a small number, turned around and said, oh, did you have to apply for it? And I said, yes. And they said, oh, well, then it's not such a big deal.
Everyone, you know, what kind of awards are there? Like, you know, it's only a very small number of awards that you don't apply.
I think every single award you have to, even if somebody nominates, you have to apply for it. You have to put in a huge amount of effort to put that application in. And I remember then when the Superstars, is the, one of the first things they did was you would have a one-to-one with sort of like a marketing person. So that was the first thing. And she said, so how do you feel? And I said, oh, I feel good, but I don't feel so good as well. And she said, why? Because I said, I had a couple of people at least turn around and ask me, so did you apply for it? And so then I felt, and she says, do you know how many people actually applied for this? And I didn't.
Oh, okay.
And there was over 1,000 people who had applied for it. So, you know, that's like, you know, and that was like, oh, all right. Yeah, so since then I have applied, you know, so I have been successful. Most of the time, like for example, the RMIT Research Award, I was nominated by the executive dean. So somebody's, and it's usually a man, has to nominate you, has to tap you on that shoulder, has to tell you that this is there. apply for it. And that is something that we need to do more. You know, and I know that since I have become, I do this more with my own staff. I send things around saying, have you considered applying for this? Are you putting your hand up for this? I think this is a good idea for you, because I know that there are people out there who are doing that for me.
Yeah, I don't think I have applied. So everything I've applied for, because someone has either asked me to or told me to. I don't think there's anything that I've applied for that I went out of my own way to do it of my own accord. Because as you said, it takes a lot of time. Yep. And, and then you've got that thing where you've put all this effort into applying for this thing and then you don't get it anyway. And you're just like, ugh, you know, I don't want to do that next time. So I think, I don't think that diminishes anything. I agree that there are very few awards that exist where people aren't, you know, if they're not self-nominating, they're not having to be a huge part of the actual application process.
Yes, somebody tapped me on the shoulder for almost everything.
So in this sense, it's very important for females to be tapped on the shoulder and to be encouraged to apply.
I think I would put it the other way around. I think it's very important for women to encourage other women, to find them to tap on the shoulder.
Oh, no, I think that's true. But then I also think it's, you know, everything I've applied for, I have been tapped on the shoulder by a man. And so I think, you know, that didn't change it for me. It was just more,
no.
I mean, even not being, I mean, part of it was not being aware of certain things.
That's right.
And then other things were just like, oh, no, there's no way I'm going to get that. And so then, you know, or, you know, you just, it's not even thinking that you would go that, you're like, oh, I wouldn't even apply because it's so irrelevant to me in every way. So I think just, you know, having that,
I'm not saying that, you know, that men shouldn't do it, but I think we women need to do it more often. Yeah. So I'm not saying that, you know, that, you know, as I said, half of what that first one was from my executive dean.
Yeah. So no, but what I wanted to, like, you know, ask was, okay, so we think it's like huge. So, suppose say we know this award exists, but we don't think of nominating because we think A, it's a huge amount of work, B, we wouldn't get. But when someone taps on the shoulder, what changes?
What changes is that that imposter syndrome changes.
That then you think, oh, I have a chance because so and so thought so.
And it's, and also the way we have looked at it, and this is, that is, so a program like the Superstars of STEM is really, really good because they actually tell you, you know, this is possible. And often it is, and so over the last 2 years, I've thought about things like what Ruth Bader Ginsburg says. She said, because she's no longer around, unfortunately, but she said there should be, if there are more of us, we will be less of a curiosity. So instead of thinking, you know, I won't get it, I need to put my hat in the ring. It's possible that you don't get it. So life is full of disappointments. So, but there, you know, you can't not do things just because you're definitely going to be disappointed. Because
you don't know that. In the first
you place. Don't know that. And Simandi, thank you. For a couple of weeks ago, I think you reminded me of exactly this thing. So, you know, that we don't know that. So I've always been, I put it in and then I don't worry about it. If I get it, I get it. If I don't, that's fine as well. So over this year, I think I have put in. So it's not only just being, so there is Women in Leadership Awards. And I know that I applied for it, I think it was late last year, beginning of this year, I can't remember, some point. And not because so much that I didn't think I would get it, but it was that there were no females of color in it. No female of color had ever won it. So it was like, okay, we need people of color to put, females of color to put their application in.
Because otherwise they'll never win it.
They will never win it. If you're not in it, you can't win the lottery if you're not in it.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. And I don't think, you know, so I was part of the ABC Top 5 Under 40 program in 2017. And, you know, I put in an application because a few people went, oh, you would be great for this. And I went, whatever. And it was a very last minute thing as well. I went, throw some things together, you know, throw it in. And I had zero expectation of even being contacted for an interview. And then I got contacted for an interview and I went, oh, well, that's good. But no way they're picking me out. I'm going to choke in the interview. There's no way, you know. And then that was the thing that sort of, you know, launched me a bit more into the SciComm stuff. And yeah, it was literally because a few people went, this would be great. Just do it. And I went, oh, fine, I'll just do it. And then it was the same thing with the Eureka stuff. I, at no stage would I have gone, oh, I'm going to enter myself in the Eureka prizes. Like, that was insane to me. And so I just did it and put this thing together. And then I ended up, you know, being a finalist twice. And I went, well, that's, you know. But I think you're right. I think we just all need to be more encouraging of each other. But I do think having that tap on the shoulder is that thing where it does remove that imposter syndrome a little bit. Because you've had people say, no, you're being crazy. Like, you are great for this. And, you know, if you get it or you don't get it, whatever. But, you know, you are at the level that, you know, throw your hat in the ring. You are competitive here.
Yes.
That's great stuff, Sophie, and great stuff, Ashley. So we have to be in the race, like, you know, so tap on the shoulder and encourage people, because like that, you it's really to encourage someone. It doesn't cost much, right? Like, so have you considered applying for that? Like, might be not even 1 minute of your time gone, and that changes that person massively from thinking, oh, I'm never thinking of applying, to putting an application in.
And it's also the thing I found with putting in an application, as you write it, it's just like the same thing as putting in for a promotion. As you write it, you realize, hey, I'm good. And I think for women, we need that.
Yeah, you're literally putting down on paper why you are good, because you're trying to sell yourself. And then when you have to do that, you go, oh, actually, I've done a bunch of not bad things. Like, this isn't terrible. Like, this, and even this is maybe a bit impressive. Like, the fact that I've done that, I feel good about that now. And because you really, you're taking that and you focused yourself in on, you know, a document that is literally just selling you. And that can be a boost in itself, for sure.
Yeah. And so, you know, I have a finalist for the Australia, India, Research and Innovation Award or something, and that was the thing. Is so one somebody I know was a finalist last year, so she then got on the panel to chase, and they said, okay, you need to find women, and so she contacted two of us that she knows, and she said, come on, you can do this.
So again, another tap on the shoulder. So that's both of you illustrating these taps on the shoulders have enormous power.
Yeah. Enormous power, absolutely. So now you will know, Sevandi, when I forward things to you, where I'm coming from.
And you have to apply.
You have to apply.
So I wanted to also ask, both of you are doing an enormous amount of outreach to promote mathematics in general, and also to promote women in mathematics, and, like, you know, so to your penetrating at different levels of the society to promote maths and all these stuff. So do you think that you get asked to contribute more for the outreach program because you're doing more? And then, you know, it's a drain because everyone has, like, it's 24 hours to work on. What are your thoughts on that? Yeah.
Indeed. It does take a lot, but it also gives energy. So I know in these past 4 months where I have been extremely flat out because of trying to do two leadership roles. Well, if you thought one was, and I remember writing to someone saying, oh, you know, I finish off on the 17th of December and I'll go to just one role. And the person wrote back to saying, you know, one role in quotation marks. So going back to being the associate associate dean. And even in the midst of that, I have done a huge amount of media, whether it is, you know, I have not said no to any media opportunity, because that's what I keep thinking. If I don't do it, then people don't see, for one, a woman, two, a woman of color, that we can actually be there because we are role models. And, you know, if you're younger, it's a little bit harder. But at this point in my career, I feel that if I don't do it, I mean, how does that message get across to kids? That this is possible. And also, you know, when I decided to do it, and I've been doing it for, I think, about 15, 16 years now, when I decided to do it, just because I wanted to do it, not because, you know, the university would give me any credit or any kudos or any time off or anything like that. And I found that it's like in research, in some ways, it is its own reward. It is its own reward because, I wrote that opinion piece with Jan in the, in the AF, in the Australian Financial Review, and put it on LinkedIn, and I had a former student write, so would you say it's integral to life? I thought that was worth it. Just that one was worth it for a former student to write that to me, you know, in a public forum. I thought, oh, this is so worth it. Gave me such a laugh, lightened my soul, I should say.
Sophie, what are your thoughts on the on outreach taking a lot of your time, you know, because you are doing research and like, you know, as, yeah.
Well, I mean, for me, I really love the outreach I do, and I think it's really important. But for me, it completely eats into my research time because I'm not that established as an academic. So I've only been back in Australia, you know, I did a postdoc in Switzerland, and then I got a lecturing position out of that. And I've only been at Macquarie, which was my first academic job in Australia. I've been there for just over 4 years. So I'm not an established academic. And my issue is that, you know, I don't have heaps of HDR students, and I, you know, and I've got some collaborations, but I don't have a lot because I haven't, you know, had time to establish myself. So for me, the thing that ends up, getting forgotten is the research, which is, it's quite funny. Like, I find myself a bit torn because I think the outreach is really important and I enjoy doing it and I'll continue to do it. But I do then struggle that, you know, here I am saying, oh, I'm an academic and look how, you know, important maths is and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I do far less maths than I would like to. And it is difficult to, you know, if I'm meant to sort of make my way as, you know, a genuine research academic, like the path that I'm on now, I don't think it's going to happen. But at the same time, you know, I am more concerned with, less concerned with what I'm doing and more concerned about the future of maths in Australia. So I just think it's something that, you know, we need to get out there, and there has to be that positive messaging and has to be changing people's perceptions from, you know, as early as, you know, primary school, but also changing perceptions of people's families and their friends, you know, because, you know, everyone gets advice and hears things from various people. But it is, like, it's a huge time sink. So I'd say for the last 3 weeks, once we got all the exam stuff wrapped up, I have, everything that I've done has been outreach or SciComm. Like, I have not had a single second to do any research, and yet by the end of next week, one of the things that I will be doing is corrections to a paper. That's one of my in my list of things to panic about, which I haven't even looked at, that I got months ago. And it's because there's, you know, the more that you do stuff, the more you get asked to do stuff. And I think it's that same thing. You're like, well, I could say no, but then now that, you know, I guess that I'm the least interesting kind of diverse. Like, I'm a woman, and everything else about me is just, you know, very typical, you know, white Australian sort of whatever. But you know, but there's that, even that little bit of, you know, representation that I can have for, you know, women, I think it is important. And if I don't do it, who's going to do it? So I still think the outreach and the SciComm is really important, and I'll continue to do it. But what it is doing is, I don't want to say it's destroying my academic career, but it really, like, it has a huge impact, I think, in a way that people don't get. And even at Macquarie now, my ratios are flipped. And that doesn't actually help. So I'm on 40% research, 40% service, and 20% teaching to acknowledge a lot of the outreach I do. And still, the thing, you know, what comes first to me is the teaching. Just because I'm doing a lot of stuff, students shouldn't be penalised. It's not their fault that I do a lot of things external to the university. So when it comes to teaching time, you know, my effort goes into teaching. And then there's always the outreach stuff that's happening throughout the year. And so it means the thing that still gets lost is that research. And I don't know, we'll see how it pans out. But it is, I think, you do end up getting asked to do more and more things. And, you know, and I've got to a level where it's, you know, I think those are really, like, beneficial things. You know, so I've been on a couple of episodes of Catalyst, and just having mathematicians on, like, primetime Australian television talking about maths in everyday life, like, that's really important. So I'm not going to say no to that opportunity. That would be madness to me. But it meant for, like, you know, surrounding that period, of course I'm not going anywhere near research. Like, it's not happening. So, yeah, I'm not sure.
The one thing I should get you to think about, Sophie, is that with regards to teaching, are you holding the students' hands too much? Because I was there, I did that, and now I don't. I found that they are quite able to fly solo.
I genuinely try not to. I think the issue that we've had is we've just had a lot of restructures constantly. So every time you're doing a unit that has existed for 20 years, we're now teaching it in a slightly different way this semester. So it involves a lot of... So I think part of it is just, you know, the time that we're in tertiary education in Australia, plus the pandemic has meant that everything is a bit of a nightmare at the moment.
Yeah, I think this year has been crazy.
Yeah, but I try not to, because, you know, and I think I've seen it as a bit harsh by some people, but to me it's like, you're at university, you're an adult, you're responsible for what happens now. I shouldn't have to hold your hand. This is when your science do this. Yeah, so I try, you know, I make myself available, But I don't do, yeah, I have to get to a point sometimes where you say, okay, you just need to calm down a bit and not email me 12 times a day with, like, very strange questions. Talk to your tutor first, and then if you can't sort it out, you know, come and see me. But, you know, it is important. But I think, you know, and the other reason that I put a lot of effort into teaching is, like, I remember being at uni and having terrible lecturers. The idea of being that person is just horrific to me, to the point where it's like, I don't want to be that person. Like, I'd rather put more effort into this and tire myself out a little bit.
Can I ask both Sophie and Asha, okay, so with the with women in mathematics, so what is your, like, you know, if you were to give the women in mathematics a message, what would your message be?
Mine would be trust yourself.
Trust yourself. You've got here. Okay.
You've got here. Trust yourself.
Okay. You've got here. Okay. Trust yourself.
Yep.
Okay, it's Sophie, and what would you say?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, it would have to be something like, I would just say just keep going.
Keep going.
I think it's that idea that, you know, a lot of times things don't go right and things are stressful and things are a bit too much, but, you know, everything does have to come to an end at some stage and then you can move on. So I just think it's that, yeah, whatever's been thrown your way that is a bit rubbish, just keep going and you'll get through it. And then, you know, I think often you come out the other end sort of a bit more resilient and a bit more sensible and a bit, you know, sort of better equipped to deal with whatever it is.
Yes, something I tell myself all the time, this too shall pass.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. So that's when bad times come, or net for good times, or for anything.
Anything. This too shall pass. To remember that, you know, the good times, you know, it's a thing that, you know, you have, if you look at, it's more like a sine curve which goes up and down. So what you need to do is reduce the amplitude, make it more, get
smaller,
more equilibrium,
little ripples
rather than massive waves which just carry you and chuck you onto the shore and beat you up, whether it is happiness or unhappiness, joy or sorrow. Just remember.
So you've got here, trust in yourself.
Yep.
And then keep going.
Yep.
And then whatever you're going through, this too will pass. What great remarks, right? Like, what great messages. So Asha and Sophie, what would you tell men on how to increase the number of women in mathematics? What is your message to them?
It's a long-term solution. You can't do it. I had the associate deans from Computer Science come up to my room last year and say, how do we fix this problem of not having enough females in computer science, given that maths at RMIT has done a great job? I think we may possibly be now at 50-50, if not, you know, more females than men, because we have lost five men due to voluntary departure packages. And the thing that I realized is that successive heads, most have been men, have constantly looked for females. And I think that's what it is. You have to realize you're biased and see how you can overcome that. You can only do it consciously. Consciously try and overcome bias.
Yeah, I would second that. I don't want to say, you know, be a better ally, but I think, you know, the idea is people need to start putting themselves in other people's shoes. And I think actually as a society, we should all do that all the time anyway, just have a bit of empathy for people. But I think it's that idea of, you know, I know that I've tried to talk to sort of male colleagues about it. And if there's any criticism, they get quite defensive and it's like, no, I'm not having a go at you. This is just a thing that happens in the system. And I think that's, you know, as I said, we need to all be better at that. When someone shares their experiences with you, to listen to those experiences and actually, you know, I guess validate them a little bit. But I think that's what it is. I think women need to be supporting women, but men need to be supporting women a bit more, because, you know, as Asha just said, it's, you know, you look at the people who are in those more powerful positions and generally they're all men, and they need to be not just aware of these issues, but actually quite, I guess, active. They need to be, it's not a, get to the point where we have so few women in this department that now it's embarrassing and we should do something about it, but actually like a little bit more preemptive, if at all possible.
It's not something, so I was asked this by someone else as well, and it was like, so how do you fix the problem? It says it's a long-term problem, a long-term solution. It's thousands of years that we have to overcome. So it's not going to happen in 5-10 years.
Yep.
It's a constant. Constant. I wouldn't say a battle. A constant awareness is how I would put it.
I've really enjoyed this podcast and talking to both of you, Sophie and Asha. Really, thank you so much for giving your time for this. And really, really enjoyed it. Lovely talking to you.
I did too. I saw different views from you, Sophie. I'm so pleased to meet you. To hear you. We should connect on Twitter. Are we connected on Twitter? I don't think we are.
I'm not sure. We'll have to go and check that after this. But yes. this has been really great. It's been a lot of, you know, it's nice to do this stuff anyway. It's been a lot of fun. It always makes it much more worthwhile when it's, you know, it's interesting and it's engaging, but it's been a lot of fun.
Yes.
Of course, this is an ongoing conversation, and we hope we were able to provide more perspective on the issue from two women who are very active in trying to affect change. If you missed our previous episode of The Random Sample, Asha and Sophie talked about the importance of a maths education and broke down some myths in maths. So check it out if you haven't heard it yet. There's some bonus material from their chat on the ASEMS webpage for this episode. There's an interesting but troubling discussion about teacher evaluations. Specifically, Sophie talks about the evaluations that she's received from some of her students.
I actually got my teaching evaluations yesterday, the second time ever that no one has commented on my gender, appearance, and anything else irrelevant to my teaching. And they've just talked about my teaching. And I don't know what it is about me, but people want to be like, oh, Sophie, she's a good lecturer, but she's really cute, and that's distracting.
On that webpage, we've also provided links to some of their outreach and media appearances. There is also a link to the AMSI report on the state of the mathematical sciences here in Australia. Just head to asems.org.au and click on episodes 43 and 44. Thanks for listening to The Random Sample, a podcast brought to you by the ARC Centre of Excellence for Mathematical and Statistical Frontiers. This is the last episode of The Random Sample for 2020. We hope you've enjoyed some of the many guests and topics we've covered over this past year, a year unlike any we've ever experienced before. While The Random Sample takes a break, you can continue to get the latest news and information we have for you on our website, asems.org.au, and you can follow ASEMS on social media at ACE Math Stats. Also, please share this podcast with your friends and family. We want others to know about the exciting things happening in maths and stats. I'm Emily Duane. Thanks for listening, and please join us again in 2021 for new episodes of The Random Sample.